Except for the theory, so how should I call this theory? And if you want to stress the importance of De Bruyne, and if you want to emphasize on this formulation of the theory, then you should probably call it the pilot wave theory, and that's the name that De Bruyne himself used. On the other hand, now it's more commonly known under the name Bohmian mechanics. And that's mainly due to the influence of Dürr, Goldstein, Zanghi in trying to make the theory popular. But of course, that's not the name that Bohm himself used. He was referring to the theory as the causal interpretation, and so did his colleagues. And in fact, there is a fourth possibility for the title. It's Introduction to the Theories of De Bruyne and Bohm. And it's not a bad one, because in the end, in the last lecture, I will show that you can think about the theories of De Bruyne and Bohm as being two different theories. But finally, I have settled for this title, Introduction to the De Bruyne-Bohm Theory, because that's John Bell himself called the theory, and his presentations are probably the nicest. And he was the one who tried to make it, to defend it as most as possible. The history? I'm going through the history now. So this story, it starts 84 years ago at the Fifth Solvay Conference of 1927. And so there, De Bruyne proposes a new theory of particles in motion, so in which particles have positions all the time, and in which the wave function acts as a kind of a guiding agent. That is, if you know the wave function and if you know all the positions of the particle, then the wave function will simply guide the particle. But at this, at the Solvay conference, De Bruyne meets strong objection, and the strongest objection were from Pauli. And after the conference, he will simply abandon the theory. And so I'm not an historian, but I think that the main reason why he abandoned the theory, it's not due to the objection of Pauli, but that's simply because the pilot wave theory, the theory that he presents at the Solvay conference, that's not the first theory that he had in mind. So that's only like an approximation of a deeper theory that he calls the double solution theory, and that he was not able to successfully implement. So the pilot wave theory is a kind of degenerate double solution theory. But then, 25 years later, David Bohm, we derived the theory. So David Bohm doesn't know about the work of De Bruyne, and he has published two papers in PhysRef in 1952, in which basically he redevives essentially the same theory, but he looks at all the situation in details, and in particular, he makes a very detailed analysis of measurement-like situation. And also, he uses a formulation which is kind of different than the one that De Bruyne initially proposed. He tries to make it look as close to the Newtonian theory as possible. And so this formulation, if you try to make the pilot wave theory look as much as possible as Newton's theory, it kind of hides the feature of the theory that De Bruyne had in mind. And then from the 60s until the end of the 80s, De Bruyne will be one of the strongest advocates of the pilot wave theory. For instance, if you look at these books, you have in this edition at least 10 of the articles in which Bell tried to convince of the importance of the De Bruyne-Bohm theory. Maybe I should just read one of the passages. So there you have the... You have one of the paper of the Bell, and this paper is called On the Impossible Pilot Wave Theory. And then John Bell say, why is the pilot wave picture ignored in textbooks? Should it not be taught, not as the only way, but as an antidote to the prevailing complacency, to show that vagueness, subjectivity, and indeterminism are not forced on us by experimental facts, but by deliberate theoretical choice. So you see, John Bell was a strong proponent of the pilot wave theory. And the nice thing about the De Broglie, about the De Broglie bomb theory, as Bell puts it in this article, is the fact that this theory doesn't need any kind of division between a quantum world and a classical world. So there is no distinction between systems and observer whatsoever. It's all about particles in motion, particles being guided by the wave, but nowhere you need to introduce a division between classical and quantum world. And this theory is also deterministic. The indeterminism only enters through the initial condition. And this has to be contrasted with the standard interpretation of quantum mechanics, where you have the quantum world, which is made of systems, which are described by wave function, and which evolve deterministically according to the Schrödinger equation, unless a member of the classical world decides to perform a measurement which causes the collapse of the wave function. And so if you ask in the standard interpretation, so where is this boundary to be found, or even why there is a boundary, then the standard interpretation does not give any answer. And it's especially dissatisfying if you think that any apparatus, any classical apparatus, is made of smaller quantum subsystems. And then with this kind of picture, you have all these problems, like the Schrödinger paradox, the Schrödinger cat paradox, and the fact that Schrödinger himself got sorry that he ever was involved. But of course, that's not the Broglie bomb theory. That's not the only theory that doesn't need any kind of division of the world between system and observers. In trying to solve the measurement problems, you can either you say that the Schrödinger equation is not right, and there you can replace the Schrödinger equation by stochastic nonlinear Schrödinger evolution, and these would be like collapse models. So as in the spirit of what Pearl, Girardi, Rimini, and Weber, Diozzi did. And you can also think about nonlinear deterministic modification of quantum mechanics. Well, there were many proposals, like by De Broglie himself, Bielicki, Brula, Mikulski, Kibble, Penrose also with the role of gravity. So Weinberg also has a formalism for nonlinear modification of quantum mechanics, but he's not concerned by, well, at least it doesn't seem to be so concerned in those papers by the role of the observer. And finally, you also have the many-world interpretations. So so let's come back to the De Broglie bomb theory. So you have many books about it. So you have this book by John Bell. You have the book by Peter Holland, The Quantum Theory of Motion. You have the book by Bohm and Eiley, The Undivided Universe. You also have the book by Dürr and Teufel, which is called Bohmian Mechanics. And you also have the book by Bacigalupi and Valentini, in which you can find the English translation of the French proceeding of the Solvay conference of 1927. So I'm just pointing out these books in case anyone is interested in more details. But so in this note, I will be, well, uh, this this lecture will be a bit biased in the sense that I will more explain the kind of particular road I'm more interested in and the stuff I've been doing in Australia. So during this first lecture, I will give a kind of general overview of the de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory, maybe including the relativistic wave equation. So in the next lecture, I will discuss how you can extend these ideas to quantum field theory. And in the last lecture, I will discuss the idea of quantum non-equilibrium, which is an idea proposed by Valentini, and this could lead to standard deviation from the standard interpretation. Okay, so if there is any question, that feel free to raise your raise your hand at any point to stop me. So it's the plan of this lecture. So I will first present the non-relativistic pilot wave theory in the simplest case. That's the one particle case. And I will illustrate it with two simple examples. So the first one is the double slit experiment. And the second one, that's the case of the hydrogen atom. Then I will discuss how you can extend this theory to the many particle case. And how does the theory manage to reproduce the prediction of standard quantum mechanics in any measurement-like situation? And then I'll discuss some technical details, like how to deal with spin 1/2 particle. What about the symmetries? Is the theory Galilean invariant? Is it time reversal invariant? What about identical particles? And then I'll discuss some issues. Well, these are not really issues in the standard sense, but they are more like topics of discussion in which members of the, let's say, the Bohmian community would have different opinions. And so finally, how to make it work for simple relativistic wave equation like the Klein-Gordon equation or the Dirac equation. So if you consider only one particle, so in the Broglie-Bohm theory, it's assumed that the particle is completely described by a wave function, psi tx, and by a particle position, and that would be xt. And as far as the equations of motion are concerned, psi tx would always evolve according to the Schrödinger equation. So there is no collapse at all in this theory. And xt would evolve according to this guidance equation. So in order to define this guidance equation, you take the standard quantum mechanical current, J, which is associated to psi squared, to this continuity equation. So if you divide J by psi squared, that gives you a velocity field on the configuration space R3. And if you simply plug in the actual position of the particle at time t, xt, you get a tree vector, and that's the velocity of the particle at time t. And if you substitute the expression of the current in this expression, you can find that it's simply equal to the gradient of the phase of the wave function divided by the mass of the particle. And now, how do we describe a quantum ensemble in the de Broglie-Bohm theory? Well, let's first consider the standard interpretation. If you have an ensemble, each element of this ensemble would be described by the same wave function. So that's all there is to it. On the other hand, if you consider the de Broglie-Bohm theory, each element of the ensemble is described by a wave function, but it's also described by a position, so that would be the red point here. And the position, of course, can vary from one element of the ensemble to the other. And the first important thing to notice is that this distribution of red point over an ensemble that I will call rho tx, in principle, it has nothing to do with psi squared. So these are two different things. But it's only if these red particle positions are distributed according to psi squared over an ensemble that the pilot wave, the Breuil-Bohm theory will reproduce the prediction of standard quantum mechanics. Because in standard quantum mechanics, if you make a position measurement, what's the probability density to find, let's say, the particle at position x that's given by psi squared? And now, if you analyze the same situation in the de Breuil-Bohm pilot wave theory, and if you make a position measurement, and if you simply reveal the actual position of the particle, the only way that the theory can reproduce the same prediction as standard quantum mechanics is if the red positions are distributed according to psi squared. Yes? Yes? You raise your hand.
Okay.
Go ahead. You want to ask a question?
Me?
No, you. It's a Jew, right?
Oh, yeah, I would like to ask a question indeed. And so is there a theoretical justification of the fact that the density and the square modulus should coincide?
Well, I'll come to this. That's the idea of, that's one of the issues called the quantum equilibrium. So that's one thing I'll come to discuss. How to explain, how you can explain the... But until now, no, I don't agree.
It's just dependent quantity.
Yes.
And just in the end.
It's only an assumption that you have to to take.
I see.
But so this will partly answer your question. Is the one of the properties of the de Breuil-Bohm theory is that once you start from an ensemble in which the particles are distributed according to, in which the particle positions are distributed according to psi squared for some initial time t, they will remain distributed according to psi squared for any later time t prime. And that simply follows from the equation of the de Breuil-Bohm theory. But you have, at this point, you have to make this assumption about the initial distribution. And here is the mathematical justification of this equivariance property. So we want to prove that the distribution would be given by psi squared for any time t, provided that it holds for some initial time t0. So you assume that this condition holds for the initial time t0, and then you simply have to show that the partial derivative of psi squared with respect to time is equal to the partial derivative of rho with respect to time. But now you use the, for the partial derivative of psi squared, you use the continuity equation, so that would be minus the divergence of J. And now for the probability density of particle position, you also have a continuity equation, except that now this part is given by rho V, where V is the velocity of the particle. And now if V is equal to J divided by psi squared, so if you replace V here by J divided by psi squared, and if you assume that this holds at the initial time t0, you have that this relation will hold too. And that's how you justify how you show that the theory is equivariant. And another way to put it is that once you, if you have this distribution at some time, t, you will have the same distribution for any later time. And that's called the quantum equilibrium, because once you are in quantum equilibrium, you remain in quantum equilibrium. So is there any other question? So now I'll simply discuss how the the theory reproduce the prediction of standard quantum mechanics in two simple cases. And the first case, that's the two-slit experiment. So if you look at the two-slit experiment in the Breuboom theory, so you have two elements. You have the wave, but you also have the particle position. So the wave, that's the same as in the standard interpretation. So the wave goes to both slits. It gets diffracted, and then you get interference. Now, if you repeat the experiment, you also have the particle position. And this particle position, over many repetitions of the same experiment, they will be distributed according to psi squared. So the position will vary from one experience to the other. But once you know the initial position, since the theory is deterministic, you can simply solve the equation of motion in order to compute the trajectory. So for instance, if the particle starts from here, so that's the trajectory that you would find for the according to the De Broglie-Bohm theory. Also, you can notice that when, if you look at regions in which the waves do not interfere, so the trajectories are almost classical. So it's only when the waves start in regions where the waves start to interfere that you have highly non-classical trajectories. Another thing that you can notice about the description of the double slit experiment in the De Broglie-Bohm theory is that the trajectories will never cross. And the reason of this is that once you know, if you know, let's say, the position of a particle, and if you know the wave function, the velocity is fixed. So there is no way, if you specify the position, the velocity should be the same. So it's impossible that the two trajectories.
The slits, you wouldn't see interference, because you said that with you know, places where the waves don't overlap, there is no, I mean, it's classical or something.
Well, that's the
so there still be interference.
Anyway. I don't know if you don't have in a region where you don't have interference of the waves, then the trajectory should be classical. So let's say if you would detect something here, but then you have to take into account, you have to include the measuring device. Here I have treated like the screen as a kind of passive. But the idea is that once you include the measuring apparatus in the theory, it's not. Well, you cannot treat the measuring device as passive. The measuring device is described by its wave function too. There is a kind of a Van Neumann interaction between the system and the apparatus, and you have to take that into account. So I'll say more about that later. And the last thing that you notice is that there is the situation is symmetrical with respect to this axis, with this plane x equal to zero. So there can't be any component of the velocity perpendicular to this plane, because it would break the symmetry. So that's the description of the two-slit experiment in the De Broglie-Bohm theory. And then you can look at the hydrogen atom. Now the funny thing about the hydrogen atom is that if you look at, so this would be, so here all these are densities that correspond to the quantum number m being equal to zero. So there is no dependence on the angle phi. And if you look at eigenstate of the energy in which there is no dependence on phi, then the wave function is real. And the only complex part in the wave function comes from the factor A minus E, A minus IET. And now if you compute the velocity of the Bohmian particle, that would be the gradient of the phase, but then the phase would be minus ET, and the gradient of the phase would be zero. So in all, if the wave function is an eigenstate of the energy with the quantum number n equal to zero, then the Bohmian particle doesn't move. But then, if you about the situation from the perspective of the Dirac equation, there should be a correction to the Geiger equation. But according to the first Geiger equation that I proposed, then nothing should move. But now you can also superpose a few eigenstates with the same quantum number m equal to zero, and then the motion would be in a nice quasi-neutral plane. So there's a kind of, trajectory that you would have for a Bohmian particle if the, the photon is over here. And this would be in a, fixed plane, in a plane where phi is fixed. And some people from the University of Waterloo, for instance, have done simulation, and they show that if you include this correction, this so-called spin term in the guidance equation, then you would have motion even in the states, even for the, eigenstate of the energy for which m is equal to, zero. So that's the De Broglie theory, as close, very close to what De Broglie initially proposed, and totally close to what to the presentation of. Done by, John Bell. But so, as I said in the introduction, Bohm re-derived the same theory in 1952, and his formulation of the theory is a bit different. So instead of using the, Schrödinger equation, he uses the polar decomposition so of the wave function. So you have the R E I times S divided by H bar. You plug that into the, Schrödinger equation. And if you do a bit of manipulation, you find two equations. So one, the first one looks like a continuity equation, provided that you interpret this, this quantity as a velocity. And the second equation is the, Hamiltonian-Jacobi equation, in which you have a, correction. So if you discard this term, this would be the, Hamilton-Jacobi equation, but now you have a new term, a new kind of potential, which is called the quantum potential. And so there is, and also you, if you look at the term in the Hamiltonian, the term that corresponds to mv squared divided by 2, well, also, you, find that you, need to interpret gradient of the phase divided by, the mass as the, velocity of the particle. And it, Bohm could have, stopped there by saying, well, the velocity of the particle are given by the gradient of the phase divided by the mass. And you need to assume this, that initially the particles are distributed according to, psi squared. But then it will go one step further in order to make the, theory look as much as Newton's theory as possible. So instead of using so simply this equation, it takes this equation as the, equation of motion of the particle. So acceleration given by minus the gradient of the usual potential, minus the gradient of the quantum potential. And so he has three assumptions in this theory. So second order guidance equation, an assumption about the initial velocities of the particle, and a third assumption about how the particles are distributed according, about how the particles are distributing, distributed for the initial time. No question about up to now? No. So when de Broglie sees this theory in the 50s, he became interested in his ideas again, but not in the pilot wave theory. So he wants to look at his whole program. The program of the double solution. So the first program that he had in mind before doing before proposing the pilot wave theory in 1927. And this double solution theory is different from the pilot wave theory in the sense that it would be a purely a wave interpretation. There would be no particle position. So his idea is to describe the particle not by positions, but by soliton-like solutions. And he proposes that any wave, any solution of the wave equation should contain two terms. The first one, that would be the, let's say, the usual wave function, plus a new term that should correspond to the particle. And this would be like a soliton-like solution. And after a discussion with Jean-Pierre Vigier in the 60s, he has realized that the only way that you can successfully, well, implement this program is by replacing the Schrödinger, the linear Schrödinger equation by the non-linear Schrödinger equation. To put it simply, if you want soliton-like solution, you need a non-linear term in order to compensate the diffusion which are caused by the linear part of the equation of motion. So that's the presentation of the theory of de Broglie of 1927, the theory of Bohm of 1952, and now I will explain how you can generalize the theory to include many particles. But now I'll stick with the formulation that was initially the one which is closest to de Broglie's formulation. So now if you consider a system of n particles, these particles, they would be completely described by their wave function, psi tx, where now capital X is a point in a configuration space of dimension 3n, and they would be also described by their position, where xt is also a point in the configuration in a configuration space of dimension 3n, and this xt represents the position of the n particles. So now, as far as the laws of motions are concerned, for the wave equation, you still keep the usual Schrödinger equation. And for the velocity of the particle, it's really close to what you do for a single particle. You simply take the component k of your current, you divide it by psi squared, and you get the velocity of particle, let's say particle number k. And also if you work out the algebra there, you would find that that's equal to the partial derivative of the phase of the wave function with respect to xk divided by mk, where mk would be the mass of particle k. And now what I would like to show is how the theory reproduces the prediction of standard quantum mechanics for any measurement. So if you do, if you do a measurement, you have some system here described by a wave function psi, and also described by its position xt zero at the initial time. And you have some measuring device that can measure some property that I will call A. And this measuring device is also described by its wave function, but also by the particle position, where the particles are the particles that belong to the measuring apparatus. And now at the initial time, T0, you can simply decompose this wave function along the eigenstates of the observable that you want to measure. And here I'll simply call these A and X. These are the eigenstates of the observable A. And C and T0, that would be the amplitude. But now the role of the measuring apparatus is to correlate the eigenstates of the observables of the observable A to pointer eigenstate of your measuring device. So in the simplest case, in which you have only, let's say, two possible measurements, you would have A0 and A1. And if you send, if you prepare the particle in a state A0, then the pointer will go, would remain in this position. If you prepare it in the A1 state, then the particle would go up. So that's the idea that any eigenstate of the observable that you want to measure gets correlated to some pointer eigenstate. And in order to do this, you can simply switch some kind of von Mann measurement between the system and the apparatus. So when the eigenstates AN have been correlated to pointer eigenstate of your measuring device, you end up with this situation. You have a superposition of branches. And these branches, they have disjoint support in the position configuration space. Simply because these branches, they correspond to different pointer state. Let's say pointer up, pointer down, and these need to have disjoint support in the position space. So after you have done your measurement, you will end up in a situation like this, in which your branches separate, and you have a region where psi squared is roughly equal to zero. And up to now, that's also valid, of course, for the standard interpretation. I haven't said anything about the De Broglie-Bohm theory. But now in the De Broglie-Bohm theory, you also have the position of the particles. So the position of the particle xt that belongs to the system that you want to measure, and the position yt that belongs to the measuring apparatus. And when you are in the situation where the branches are separated, you also have the particle position, and they need to enter one of the packets, because they cannot go in region where psi squared is equal to zero. So necessarily they need to enter one of the packets. But once they enter one of the packets, so if you look at this situation, for instance, in which the position of the particle are there, so here you have only a contribution from this branch of the wave function, but you don't have any contribution from this branch. So as far as the velocity of the particle is concerned, you don't have any contribution from this branch of the wave function. And so as far as the velocity of the particle are concerned, you can simply discard this packet. And that's how the collapse takes place in the De Broglie-Bohm theory. So it's only an effective collapse. But the other branch of the wave function is still there. And this is also referred to as a kind of empty wave, because once you do the measurement, the particle position gets trapped in one of the branches, and you remain with this empty packet there that cannot contribute anymore to the guidance of your particles.
That we really see the point.
Well, yeah, you see the point.
And we don't disturb position by observing.
What do we do? No, you can do when you, if you see your point there, you really see the, it's assumed that you really see the actual position of the what you see, mm-hmm. That's this idea over there. That's the position.
So in principle, for any particle, we can see the position.
Yeah, but of course, it will be. That's in practice, it's not possible because you cannot simply.
But at least in
you can't reduce like the wave function to an arbitrary small support. Well, then you have to go to quantum field theory.
But even if the wave function is very spread, we assume that. There is always such a thing as the position.
Yes.
And the question is this observable, at least in principle, or?
Well, the position that's a step that you that you observe.
Okay.
So in principle, you could do an arbitrary fine-grained measure.
Well, you could do this, but you do this.
Yes, sure.
Yes, and in principle, there is nothing, yes, in the theory that forbids you to do like an arbitrary fine grain.
So, what's the meaning of the rho then? So, rho is a classical probability density, right? And at the moment that you actually do your measurement, it's assumed that this kind of collapses to one outcome. Right, so similar
to
classical probability theory, is that true?
The row, you mean like this
function here, yes. So it has some value initially, and then you have the measurement, and then you actually observe the particle somewhere, right?
Yes, but it's a distribution of an ensemble. So yeah, I'm just doing one experiment, but this row, this distribution is over an it's defined over, just like in quantum mechanics, over an ensemble of identical systems which are described by the same wave function.
Yes, but then you have the row entering your differential equation, so this means that the movement of a single particle is affected by the ensemble as a total, right? So even if you have only one, and you only observe the one, it still kind of feels the rest of the ensemble.
So I'm not sure I get the...
Okay, maybe.
But now if you ask what's the probability to, let's say, to observe the system in this configuration, that would be equal to the probability for the particle position to become trapped in this particular packet. And then, if you want to compute this probability, you have to integrate the probability density for the particle to be in that packet over that support. And now, if initially they would be distributed according to the standard quantum distribution, that's how you can reproduce the prediction of standard quantum mechanics. So now I'll discuss, let's say, a few. As I said, technical details, so you can how do you deal with spin and symmetries. So now, if you have a spin one half particle, in the simplest case, it would be described by this equation in which you have a strong elect term where B is the magnetic field and sigma is the Pauli, these are the Pauli matrices. And now, if you want to do the double bond theory for this, for a spin 1/2 particle, you simply apply the same trick as before. So you take some probability density. In this case, it would be psi by psi. You compute the current which is associated to psi by psi. That would be psi by number psi. And for the velocity, you take the current divided by psi squared. And this would ensure that if the particle positions are distributed according to this density for some initial time t0, they would remain distributed according to this density for any vector term, t. But so here there is no B-able related to the spin. There is only a B-able. Sometimes I'm using this word B-able. By B-able, I mean the things that exist, the real thing that exists beside the wave function. So particle position, these would be the B-ables, the things that are, the things that exist. So the particle position, that's the only B-able or element of reality. And when you do a Stern Gerlach experiment, and if you send a superposition of spin up and spin down state, so what's happening is that the two spin up, the branch that correspond to spin up will go up, and the branch that correspond to spin down will go down. But in the end, you observe a position on the screen. So you observe the particle position. You observe the B-able. And so what you observe in the end depends on where the particle started in the packet, because the theory is deterministic. But if the particle ends up in the packet that corresponds to spin up, you would say I have seen spin up. So there is no B-able or element of reality attributed to the spin. In the Breitbaum theory, one way to put it is that spin is only a property of the wave function. And now, so let's discuss a few symmetries. The one is the first one, that's the Galilean invariance. So let's imagine that you have two reference frames, initial reference frames, so sigma and sigma prime, where sigma prime is moving with velocity u with respect to sigma. And let's also assume that the origins coincide at the initial time. So sigma, if he describes the particle, he would describe some wave function psi tx. On the other hand, if sigma prime describes the same particle, he would ascribe some wave function psi prime tx prime. And these two are related by the following transformation. So at the standard level, the fact that the theory is Galilean invariant means that if you start from the Schrödinger equation, and if you prime everything, so if you put psi prime here, if you put x prime, and if you replace the Laplacian by Laplacian prime, and if you use this transformation, you will recover the Schrödinger equation in the unprime system. But now, in the Breitbaum theory, you have the Schrödinger equation, but you have also the guidance equation for your particle. And now, if you start from the situation in the reference frame sigma prime, and if you write down V prime is equal to the gradient with respect to S prime, X prime of S prime that depends on Tx prime, you would recover the other guidance, the same guidance equation, but in the unprime system. So that's how the theory is Galilean invariance, and that's of course, that's closely related to how the standard in the theory is Galilean invariant itself. And here there is a paper by Valentini which he argues that Galilean invariance is a kind of fictitious symmetry in the pilot wave theory. Well, for those who are interested. So what about time reversal now? So in the standard interpretation, time reversal means that if you have some wave function psi tx, then if you take the complex conjugate of, if you take its complex conjugate and if you replace t by minus t, you also have a solution of the Schrödinger equation. So that part is still true in the Breuboehm theory, but you have also the part which is related to the guidance equation. And now, in the Breuboehm theory, if you have the time reversal invariance is expressed in this way, if you have some solution psi tx and some trajectory xt, then the couple in which the wave function is time reverse and the trajectory is also time reverse would also be a solution. So that's the expression of time reversal invariance in the Breuboehm theory. And now what about identical particles? So in the standard interpretation, if you consider identical particle, let's say two bosons, so the wave function would be symmetric under a permutation of the two indices. And now, in the Breuboehm theory, you also have the guidance equation for the trajectory of the... You also have the guidance equation that determines the trajectories of the particles. But now, if you look at this equation, so the trajectory that you can compute don't depend on whether you label this particle 1 or this particle 2. If you would do the reverse, label this by this particle by 2 and this particle by 1, then that wouldn't change anything. Not just like the one that you have in quantum field theory, but the part from that.
Because in quantum theory, one usually appears to the fact that the particle, identical particles are indistinguishable because we don't have the trajectories to distinguish them. Well, here we do have the trajectories. So is there a different argument? Or?
Well, here you have the trajectory that you don't see. Well, I can argue that I don't see, I can't see the trajectory.
Mm-hmm. So there is some like empirical reason why we don't see trajectories, or we could, in principle, do.
Well, the only reason that you don't see the trajectory is that if you try to measure the trajectory of the Bohmian particle, so the particle is described by its wave function and also by its position, but when you measure the position, you would change the wave function. And you would change the way that the particle moves.
Okay.
That's how you can explain that you cannot reveal the exact trajectory for the Bohmian particle. Just because when you try to make it, you know.
Okay, sir.
Yeah, my question is about, just following up the previous question. About symmetric and anti-symmetric. So you are arguing that the potential and so Hamiltonian is symmetric, but in quantum mechanics you have something more. It's not just the Hamiltonian is symmetric. You also have this assumption that fermions are anti-symmetric and bosons are symmetric, and it does not come from just the symmetry of Hamiltonian.
This ultimately you have to go to quantum field theory if you.
So are you claiming that? I mean, how do you explain that here? I mean, you're just saying that the Hamiltonian is symmetric with respect to. But I'm saying that there is.
So I'm just saying that, well, they would also be described by a wave function which is either symmetric or anti-symmetric. And then that the way that you label the two particles at the level of the guided equation doesn't change in the end what you, the result that you have when you compute the trajectories.
Yeah, but is there any argument that your initial state should be either symmetric or your initial state?
No, well, not more than in. No, there is no special. Yes.
So, this property of fermionic statistics under interchange, is that a property of the wave function or a property of the particles? I mean, are the particles themselves described by positions that are Grassmann numbers? Or
No. These are not, the positions are not Grassmann numbers, they are just like usual
numbers.
Yeah, just numbers.
So it's a property of the wave function, really.
No, it's at the level of the wave function.
Is there also a spin statistics like theorem here?
Well, at this stage, all the which is true for standard quantum mechanics will carry to the Broglie. Because you have these two levels, you have the level of the wave function in which all the theorems that you have are still valid. But then if I complement by adding particle position, I won't change anything at the level of the wave functions. But these authors, well, I don't know if it is going to say a bit more, but it's true that so let's say I have two identical particles in a one-dimensional box. And if I look, if I look at the configuration space for these two particles, and if I look at the particle position, so it would be a box in R2. But then, if there is no way to distinguish the two particles, I'm using twice the configuration space that the one I need. So I can simply forget this part of the configuration space for the particle position and use, a triangle. And this author in this paper tried to use this kind of reduced configuration space. Is there any further question about these identical particles?
The relaxation of the particle distribution. The second property.
You mean this one?
Yes. Is it possible to justify this with the relaxation of the probability distribution? Towards the equilibrium.
Okay, but no, this one you don't have to, this one is true, you don't have to justify anything.
But is it possible to justify this property? Suppose that at the initial time you don't have this property. Is it possible to justify this property with the relaxation of the trajectories?
Well, I can easily, that's one thing I can, if I put two identical particles in a box, I can easily come up with quantum non-equilibrium distribution that would never relax to quantum equilibrium. Quantum non-equilibrium, that's derived. So if I start, so these quantum non-equilibrium that Alberto is mentioning, these are particular ensembles in which the particles are not distributed according to size square. And this idea of relaxation to quantum equilibrium, I'll say a bit about it in this lecture. That's the idea that even if you start from a system in which the particles are not distributed according to size square, and if you let this system evolve, they would relax to the distribution rho equal to size square. But now, if I start from to reply to your question, if I start from if I put two identical particles in a box, and if I use this configuration space, and if I start from a non-equilibrium distribution, in which I put something, some part of the distribution is above this diagonal and some part is below, that would never relax to a quantum equilibrium. Because you can never cross this. But maybe I'll say something more about it in the lecture number two. Okay, no, so I'll discuss a bit of these, as I said, I refer in the introduction to these as issues, but these are more topics of discussion in which people don't agree. So you have, if you remember, you have this, so this this equivariance property. If you start from this distribution, it will remain. If particular distribution are according, particle position are distributed according to psi square for some initial time to zero, it will remain true for any later time t. But then you have to make this assumption about the initial time t zero. You have to take it as an assumption. And of course you would like to justify this assumption because, well, the distribution of particle position and psi squared, so these are two different things. So why should the distribution of particle position given by psi squared at the initial time t zero? There is no reason for that. But some people are happy to take it as an assumption, for instance Brickmore in this paper. But two other groups have tried to propose an answer to this question. And the first answer to this question was proposed by, well, actually they both came at the same time, the beginning of the 90s. But the first answer to this question about the initial quantum equilibrium was proposed by Dürer-Goldstein and John Lee. And what they want to show in their paper is that if you live in a Bohmian universe, you have two types of wave function. You have the wave function for the entire universe, but you also have wave functions at the level of the subsystem. And they want to show that, it's not that they want to show, they show in the end that if most initial configuration for your Bohmian universe would lead to psi squared at the level of the subsystems. But most should be taken with a pinch of salt, if you like. And the other reply to this, in order to try to justify this assumption, was proposed by Valentini. And that's the idea that even if you start from some initial distribution in which the particle positions are not distributed according to psi squared, and if you let it evolve, it would relax to quantum equilibrium. So I'll first discuss the reply by Dürer, Goldstein, and Zhang Yi. So they say that, so if you look at the Bohmian universe, you have a description at the level of the universe itself. So the universe would be described by a big wave function, psi u, but also by some the position of all the particles in the universe, and these would be collectively denoted by xu. And they want to show that you can find some initial condition for which the quantum equilibrium will hold at the level of the subsystem. And in fact, they do more than that. But the first thing that you have to define is the wave function of a subsystem. And here is how you do it in Bohm's theory. So you make some splitting of the particle position. So you say, I have some particle positions that belong to my system, and I have some particle position that belongs to my environment. And now, if you, in the Bohm theory, you also have the actual position of the particle, so you have XST and XET. And if you take the universal wave function and if you plug in the actual position of the particles that correspond to your environment, you end up with some wave function that only depends on the position of your system. And that's how you can define a wave function for a subsystem in the de Broglie-Bohm theory. And typically, in a measurement-like situation in which the branches cease to overlap, this would behave as according to the Schrödinger equation. So now that they have defined the wave function for a subsystem, they consider a wave function for the universe which corresponds to a product of identical subsystems. And then they show that most initial configuration for universal configuration XU would lead to quantum equilibrium at the level of the system. But the problem is, how do you, when they say that most initial configuration lead to quantum equilibrium at the level of the subsystem, you have to associate a measure to each of the configuration of the universe. So you have to weight each universal configuration by psi squared. So the most is associated to the psi squared measure, but these are, I'll come back to it in the third lecture three. But then if you agree with this, the fact that most initial configurations So most initial configuration of the universe would lead to psi squared at the level of the subsystem. And then there is the second proposal, and that's the proposal by Valentini. That's the idea that you can start from distribution in which you have non-equilibrium in the beginning. So in this picture, so these were simulations done by Anthony and Hans Westman. So on the top row, you have the wave function, the density for a particle in a two-dimensional box. So that's the density for time t equal to zero. That's the density for time t equal to pi, and that's the density for time t equal to 4 pi. And they have shown that if you start from a distribution which is different from psi squared at the initial time t, t zero, and if you let it evolve, and then you have relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And this would be the subject of the last lecture. But then you get the idea, the two kind of answer that can be proposed to explain quantum equilibrium. So now I'll say a few things about serialistic trajectories, and that's the fact that the trajectories that are predicted by the Breuboom theory, these are highly non-classical. And in order to illustrate this, you can consider the Wheeler-Dillet-Choy experiment. So that's the two-slit experiment. Here you have some interference of the wave, and here you have some detectors, C1 and C2, which are positional detectors. And at the last moment, after the particle has passed through the slit, you can decide to insert a screen in this region in order to observe interference effects. But now, in the Breuboom theory, so if you remember from the two-slit experiment, you have this symmetry with respect to this plane, x equal to 0. So the particle can never cross this plane. So what happens in this experiment is that the particle will simply bounce off as it reaches this plane. And the same, of course, for if it starts from below. But now, if you decide to make a position measurement, and if you insert a detector here, you would break this symmetry. And let's say if you detect the particle in a detector here, automatically you would see the particle in C1. Simply because by inserting this measuring apparatus here, you destroy the symmetry. And you have also separation of the branches, and the particle position is forced to choose to enter one of these branches. And the idea of Englert and El Al was to consider one-bit detectors. And if you insert one-bit detectors, you don't destroy this symmetry of the trajectories. So if you insert these two one-bit detectors here, you still have the particle will bounce off. So they agree that they say that the Bobian trajectory can be at variance with what is observed in the lab, because this could be detected and you would observe, well, that's the idea, and that you would still observe the particle there. So they say that there is something wrong with the Breuboom theory. But the answer to this is that if you have this one-bit detector, they don't record anything in the position basis. So in the Breuboom theory, you would not count this as measurement. If you do a measurement, you have to end up with macroscopically a distinct state, and you would end up with a situation like this, in which if you detect the particle here, the particle goes there. No, I'll say the last thing about these topics of discussion, and that's the idea of the non-uniqueness of the guidance equation. And that's the idea that, in fact, you can construct infinitely many theories, like the Breuboom theory, that gives you the same prediction as standard quantum mechanics. And this can be introduced in the following way. So if you go back to equivariance, so the property that this will hold, this relation will hold if it holds for some initial time T0. That stems from the fact that you use the velocity field. You define the velocity field as J divided by psi squared. And that J and psi squared are associated to a continuity equation. But if you would add some rotational here, that wouldn't change anything as far as the continuity equation is concerned. So because if you take the divergence of this term, this gives you zero. So I could as well define a de Broglie-Bohm type theory in which I take the velocity field as J plus some rotational divided by psi squared. And this would give the same prediction as standard quantum mechanics. And these kind of theories, this possibility to construct infinitely many theories was studied by D'Otto and Girardi. And they have shown that even if you impose additional constraints on the velocity field, like Galilean invariance, for instance, you still end up with infinitely many candidates for the Broglie-Bohm type theories. And in fact, if you think that the Broglie-Bohm theory should come, if you consider, for instance, the Pauli equation, if you think of the Pauli equation as the non-relativistic limit of the Dirac equation, you should get such a correction to the guidance equation. And you get what is called a spin term. And now many people have proposed arguments in order to select one of these de Broglie-Bohm theory. For instance, Dürr, Goldstein, and Zanghi have argued that V equals grad S divided by the mass is the most simplest choice of guidance equation. Peter Holland has argued that if you consider the Dirac current, and if you try to do the same thing, then if you try to add to this Dirac current some term A mu, which is also divergenceless, this would imply that the zero component of this A mu has to be equal to zero in all the initial frames. So then the argument would not work. And finally, Wiseman has argued that if you define the if you try to obtain an operational definition of the velocity through weak measurements, then the one that you get would coincide with the initial de Broglie-Bohm velocity. And so this is the most natural choice. And in order to do this, he introduced the idea of weak measurement. And the way that you defined the velocity of the particle, you first do at time t, you do a weak measurement of the position, and then you do a strong measurement of the position at time t plus dt. And you only consider these events for which the strong measurement at time t plus dt gives you some value x. Then you have to repeat many times the experiment in order to get rid of the noise, which is introduced by the weak measurement, in order to define operationally the velocity field at some point x. And if you do the calculation, then this operational definition coincides with the usual de Broglie-Bohm velocity. Okay, the last thing I should probably say for today is that this theory, the de Broglie-Bohm theory, that's a non-local theory. So it's grounded in the configuration space of R3n. And if you look at the velocity of one of the particles, it depends on, at some time t, it depends on all the position of the other particle in the system, no matter how far they are separated. But that's because this is the theory which is defined on the configuration space. So that's a non-local theory. And then there is this issue about whether a non-local theory can be made compatible with Lorentz covariance. And some people are actively trying to make, let's say, the double Elbaum theory Lorentz covariant. And the way that they do this is by trying to introduce some preferred foliation of space-time, which is defined in a covariant way. But this is a kind of non-serious Lorentz covariance. And the question of a serious Lorentz covariance, that's still an open problem. So I should probably stop here. Thanks. So I'll cover the relativistic wave equation in the next lecture. Is there any question? Well, I guess.
I have a quick question, which is like, if I understand right, none of the predictions of this theory contradict with the, you know, usual predictions of usual quantum mechanics. My question is like, does this predict anything beyond what normal quantum mechanics predicts? And if not, why is this, you know, any better than the Copenhagen or, you know, the normal interpretations?
No, Well, I can say two things about this. First, that you have this idea that you can consider, instead of considering ensembles in which the particle positions are distributed according to psi squared, you could also consider ensembles in which the particles are not distributed according to psi squared. And you have very special particles for which you would never have this process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And these would lead to different predictions than standard quantum mechanics. And that's this idea of quantum non-equilibrium. So that's the first kind of, that's a deviation. If quantum non-equilibrium exists and if you can find it somewhere in the universe, then you could use it to have different predictions than standard quantum mechanics. But I haven't said anything about quantum equilibrium yet. Yes, this could have new predictions. And also, well, the advantage of the Copenhagen interpretation, as I put in the beginning, the fact that this theory can be clearly defined without introducing any distinction between, like, systems on the systems and observer in the. Well, so honestly, I think that I'm not too interested about. No, I think it's a good argument because. So if you look at the pilot wave theory, so that's something that the guidance equation takes this form, so V equals the gradient of S divided by mass. So now you are motivated by looking for Galilean invariance in which you have theories in which the acceleration is equal to something, because then the acceleration is the same in all the inertial frames. But now if you have a theory, so Galilean invariance is related to the fact that the Galilean equation is acceleration by something. And so here, the fact that you have a theory in which V is equal to is the Galilean equation, so what? You can reasonably question, so why are you looking at Galilean invariance? But I think that these questions are. Whether you should put try to build a Lorentz covariant Well, first you should meet, you need to obtain a good theory for a good pilot wave model for quantum field theory, and then you start to look at this question. I think that now it's a bit too trying to solve too many things. Question?